This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, please visit LibriVox.org. That's LibriVox.org. This reading by Gordon Mackenzie. Scaramouche, A Romance of the French Revolution, by Raphael Sabatini, Book 1, Chapter 6, The Windmill. There was, between Nantes and Rennes, an established service of 3 stagecoaches weekly in each direction, which, for a sum of 24 livres, roughly the equivalent of an English guinea, would carry you the 70 and odd miles of the journey in some 14 hours. Once a week, one of the diligences, going in each direction, would swerve aside from the high road to call at Gavrillac, to bring and take letters, newspapers, and sometimes passengers. It was usually by this coach that André Louis came and went when the occasion offered. At present, however, he was too much in haste to lose a day awaiting the passing of that diligence. So it was on a horse hired from the Breton Arm that he set out next morning, and an hour's brisk ride under a grey wintry sky by a half-ruined road through 10 miles of flat, uninteresting country brought him to the city of Rennes. He rode across the main bridge over the Vilaine, and so into the upper and principal part of that important city of some 30,000 souls, most of whom, he opined from the seething, clamant crowds that everywhere blocked his way, must on this day have taken to the streets. Clearly Philippe had not overstated the excitement prevailing there. He pushed on as best he could, and so came at last to the Place Royale, where he found the crowd to be most dense. From the plinth of the equestrian statue of Louis XV, a white-faced young man was excitedly addressing the multitude. His youth and dress proclaimed the student, and a group of his fellows, acting as a guard of honor to him, kept the immediate precincts of the statue. Over the heads of the crowd, André Louis caught a few of the phrases flung forth by that eager voice.
"It was the promise of the king. It is the king's authority they flout. They abrogate to themselves the whole sovereignty in Brittany. The king has dissolved them. These insolent nobles defying their sovereign and the people."
Had he not known already, from what Philippe had told him, of the events which had brought the Third Estate to the point of active revolt, those few phrases would fully have informed him. This popular display of temper was most opportune to his need, he thought, and in the hope that it might serve his turn by disposing to reasonableness the mind of the king's lieutenant, he pushed on up the wide and well-paved Rue Royale, where the concourse of people began to diminish. He put up his hired horse at the Comte de Cerf, and set out again, on foot, to the Palais de Justice. There was a brawling mob by the framework of poles and scaffoldings about the building cathedral, upon which work had been commenced a year ago, but he did not pause to ascertain the particular cause of that gathering. He strode on, and thus came presently to the handsome Italianate palace that was one of the few public edifices that had survived a devastating fire of 60 years ago. He won through with difficulty to the great hall, known as the Salle des Pas Perdus, where he was left to cool his heels for a full half hour after he had found an usher so condescending as to inform the god who presided over that shrine of justice that a lawyer from Gavrillac humbly begged an audience on an affair of gravity. That the god condescended to see him at all was probably due to the grave complexion of the hour. At long length he was escorted up the broad stone staircase, and ushered into a spacious, meagerly furnished anteroom, to make one of a waiting crowd of clients, mostly men. There he spent another half hour, and employed the time in considering exactly what he would say. This consideration made him realize the weakness of the case he proposed to set before a man whose views of law and morality were colored by his social rank. At last he was ushered through a narrow but very massive and richly decorated door into a fine, well-lighted room, furnished with enough gilt and satin to have supplied the boudoir of a lady of fashion. It was a trivial setting for a king's lieutenant, but about the king's lieutenant there was, at least to ordinary eyes, nothing trivial. At the far end of the chamber, to the right of one of the tall windows that looked out over the inner court, before a goat-legged writing-table with Watteau panels, heavily encrusted with ormolu, sat that exalted being. Above a scarlet coat with an order flaming on its breast, and a billow of lace in which diamonds sparkled like drops of water, sprouted the massive powdered head of Monsieur de Lesdiguières. It was thrown back to scowl upon this visitor with an expectant arrogance that made André Louis wonder almost was a genuflection awaited from him. Perceiving a lean, lantern-jawed young man with straight, lank black hair in a caped riding coat of brown cloth and yellow buckskin breeches, his knee-boots splashed with mud, the scowl upon that august visage deepened until it brought together the thick black eyebrows above the great hooked nose. "You announce yourself as a lawyer of Gavrillac with an important communication," he growled. It was a peremptory command to make this communication without wasting the valuable time of a king's lieutenant, of whose immense importance it conveyed something more than a hint. Monsieur de Lesdiguières accounted himself an imposing personality, and he had every reason to do so, for in his time he had seen many a poor devil scared out of all his senses by the thunder of his voice. He waited now to see the same thing happen to this youthful lawyer from Gavrillac, but he waited in vain. André Louis found him ridiculous. He knew pretentiousness for the mask of worthlessness and weakness, and here he beheld pretentiousness incarnate. It was to be read in that arrogant poise of the head, that scowling brow, that inflection of that reverberating voice. Even more difficult than it is for a man to be a hero to his valet, who has witnessed the dispersal of the parts that make up the imposing whole, is it for a man to be a hero to the student of man who has witnessed the same in a different sense. André Louis stood forward boldly, impudently, thought Monsieur de Lesdiguières. "You are His Majesty's lieutenant here in Brittany," he said, and it almost seemed to the august lord of life and death that this fellow had the incredible effrontery to address him as one man speaking to another. "You are the dispenser of the king's high justice in this province." Surprise spread on that handsome, sallow face under the heavily powdered wig. "Is your business concerned with this infernal insubordination of the canaille?" he asked. "It is not, monsieur." The black eyebrows rose. "Then what the devil do you mean by intruding upon me at a time when all my attention is being claimed by the obvious urgency of this disgraceful affair?" "The affair that brings me is no less disgraceful and no less urgent."
"It will have to wait," thundered the great man in a passion,
and tossing back a cloud of lace from his hand, he reached for the little silver bell upon his table.
"A moment, monsieur."
André Louis' tone was peremptory. Monsieur de Lesdiguières checked in sheer amazement at its impudence. "I can state it very briefly."
"Haven't I said already?"
"And when you have heard it," André Louis went on relentlessly, interrupting the interruption, "you will agree with me as to its character." Monsieur de Lesdiguières considered him very sternly.
"What is your name?" he asked.
"André Louis Moreau."
"Well, André Louis Moreau,
If you can state your plea briefly, I will hear you. But I warn you that I shall be very angry if you fail to justify the impertinence of this insistence at so inopportune a moment." "You shall be the judge of that, monsieur," said Andre Louis, and he proceeded at once to state his case, beginning with the shooting of Mabey, and passing thence to the killing of Monsieur de Vilmorin. But he withheld until the end the name of the great gentleman against whom he demanded justice, persuaded that, did he introduce it earlier, he would not be allowed to proceed. He had a gift of oratory of whose full powers he was himself hardly conscious yet, though destined very soon to become so. He told his story well, without exaggeration, yet with a force of simple appeal that was irresistible. Gradually the great man's face relaxed from its forbidding severity. Interest, warming almost to sympathy, came to be reflected on it.
"And who, sir, is the man you charge with this?"
"The Marquis de La Tour d'Azyr." The effect of that formidable name was immediate. Dismayed anger and an arrogance more utter than before took the place of the sympathy he had been betrayed into displaying.
"Who?"
he shouted, and without waiting for an answer.
"Why, here's impudence," he stormed on. "To come before me with such a charge against a gentleman of Monsieur de La Tour d'Azyr's eminence! How dare you speak of him as a coward?"
"I speak of him as a murderer," the young man corrected, "and I demand justice against him."
"You demand it, do you? My God, what's next?"
"That is for you to say, monsieur." It surprised the great gentleman into a more or less successful effort of self-control.
"Let me warn you," said he acidly, "that it is not wise to make wild accusations against a nobleman. That in itself is a punishable offense, as you may learn. Now listen to me in this matter of Mabey, assuming your statement of it to be exact. The gamekeeper may have exceeded his duty, but by so little that it is hardly worth comment. Consider, however, that in any case it is not a matter for the king's lieutenant, or for any court but the seigneurial court of Monsieur de La Tour d'Azyr himself. It is before the magistrates of his own appointing that such a matter must be laid, since it is matter strictly concerning his own seigneurial jurisdiction. As a lawyer you should not need to be told so much."
"As a lawyer I am prepared to argue the point. But as a lawyer I also realize that if that case were prosecuted it could only end in the unjust punishment of a wretched gamekeeper, who did no more than carry out his orders, but who nonetheless would now be made a scapegoat, if scapegoat were necessary. I am not concerned to hang Bennett on the gallows earned by Monsieur de La Tour d'Azyr." Monsieur de Lesdiguières smote the table violently.
"My God!" he cried out,
to add more quietly on a note of menace,
"You are singularly insolent, my man."
"That is not my intention, sir. I assure you, I am a lawyer, pleading his case, the case of Monsieur de Vilmorin. It is for his assassination that I have come to beg the king's justice."
"But you yourself have said that it was a duel,"
cried the lieutenant, between anger and bewilderment. "I have said that it was made to appear a duel. There is a distinction, as I shall show, if you will condescend to hear me out."
"Take your time, sir,"
said the ironical Monsieur de Lesdiguières, whose tenure of office had never yet held anything that remotely resembled this experience. Andre Louis took him literally. "I thank you, sir," he answered solemnly, and submitted his argument. "It can be shown that Monsieur de Vilmorin never practiced fencing in all his life. and it is notorious that M. de La Tour d'Azyr is an exceptional swordsman. Is it a duel, monsieur, where one of the combatants alone is armed? For it amounts to that on a comparison of their measures of respective skill.
There has scarcely been a duel fought on which the same trumpery argument might not be advanced.
But not always with equal justice, and in one case at least it was advanced successfully.
Successfully? When was that?
10 years ago in Dauphiny. I refer to the case of Monsieur de Gevrey, a gentleman of that province, who forced a duel upon Monsieur de La Roche, Jeannine, and killed him. Monsieur de Jeannine was a member of a powerful family, which exerted itself to obtain justice. It put forward just such arguments as now obtain against Monsieur de La Tour d'Azyr. As you will remember, the judges held that the provocation had proceeded on intent from Monsieur de Gevrey. They found him guilty of premeditated murder, and he was hanged. Monsieur de Lesdiguières exploded yet again.
"Death of my life!" he cried.
"Have you the effrontery to suggest that Monsieur de La Tour d'Azyr should be hanged? Have you?"
"But why not, monsieur, if it is the law, and there is precedent for it, as I have shown you, and if it can be established that what I state is the truth, as established it can be without difficulty?"
"Do you ask me why not? Have you temerity to ask me that?"
"I have, monsieur. Can you answer me? If you cannot, monsieur, I shall understand that whilst it is possible for a powerful family like that of La Roche-Jeannine to set the law in motion, the law must remain inert for the obscure and uninfluential, however brutally wronged by a great nobleman."
Monsieur de Lesdiguières perceived that in argument he would accomplish nothing against this impassive, resolute young man. The menace of him grew more fierce. "I should advise you to take yourself off at once, and to be thankful for the opportunity to depart unscathed."
"I am then to understand, monsieur, that there will be no inquiry into this case? That nothing that I can say will move you?"
"You are to understand that if you are still there in 2 minutes, it will be very much the worse for you."
And Monsieur de Lesdiguières tinkled the silver handbell upon his table. "I have informed you, monsieur, that a duel, so called, has been fought, and a man killed. It seems that I must remind you, the administrator of the king's justice, that duels are against the law, and that it is your duty to hold an inquiry. I come as the legal representative of the bereaved mother of Monsieur de Vilmorin to demand of you the inquiry that is due." The door behind André Louis opened softly. Monsieur de Lesdiguières, pale with anger, contained himself with difficulty.
"You seek to compel us, do you? You impudent rascal," he growled. "You think that the king's justice is to be driven headlong by the voice of any impudent roturier? I marvel at my own patience with you. But I give you a last warning, master lawyer. Keep a closer guard over that insolent tongue of yours, or you will have cause very bitterly to regret its glibness."
He waved a jeweled, contemptuous hand, and spoke to the usher standing behind André.
"To the door," he said shortly.
André Louis hesitated a second. Then with a shrug he turned. This was the windmill, indeed, and he, a poor knight of rueful countenance, to attack it at close quarters would mean being dashed to pieces. Yet on the threshold he turned again. "Monsieur de Lesdiguières," said he, "may I recite to you an interesting fact in natural history? The tiger is a great lord in the jungle, and was for centuries the terror of lesser beasts, including the wolf. The wolf, himself a hunter, wearied of being hunted, he took to associating with other wolves, and then the wolves, driven to form packs for self-protection, discovered the prowler of the pack, and took to hunting the tiger, with disastrous results to him. You should study Buffon, Monsieur de Lesdiguières.
I have studied a buffoon this morning, I think, was the punning sneer with which Monsieur de Lesdiguières replied.
But that he conceived himself witty, it is probable he would not have condescended to reply at all.
I don't understand you, he added.
But you will, Monsieur de Lesdiguières. You will, said Andre Louis, and so departed.
End of chapter 6.